My aunt's little ones are doing a 9-week course. And I mean, I know they're really olic and stuff, but I just think it's kind of cruel. Because when she says sit, they sit. When she says come, they come. And now, she's teaching them tricks, like party tricks and stuff. I mean, it's exploitation. Come on, I mean, the poor dogs.
A combination meal. Inspired by 7 colors, there's something for everyone. Nando's. Fire it up.
CliffCentral.com. Hey, hey, hey. You're listening to Students Uncensored with Ruby Chukwuri. I, of course, am Ruby Chukwuri, and today's topic will be mental health among students. Mental health includes social, psychological, and the emotional well-being of people. Joining me in studio today is Zanele Zumu, who is now officially a University of Cape Town graduate.
What can I say? What can I say? you know, I'm doing the thing.
Does it feel different?
I must say it feels, you know, a bit, I'm just joking, I'm scared. I'm unemployed. I don't know what I'm doing. It's scary.
Okay, and also joining us in studio is Chioma Umela.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Chioma. And our special guest for today is Zamo Mbele, who is a qualified clinical psychologist in Johannesburg. He is also a board member of the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, and he forms part of the multidisciplinary team at the Wits Donald Gordon Medical Center in Parktown. Thank you for joining us in studio today, Zamo.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so as I said earlier, today's topic is mental health among students. So I just wanted to first start off by explaining, you know, why this topic is important and why we're discussing it today. So it's commonly known that students are struggling with mental health, and we clearly do not talk about this topic enough. We're suffering emotionally, we're suffering physically, mentally and financially, and we definitely need to have more open discussions to find solutions. The mental health of students needs to be made a priority in educational institutions. So I just wanted to start off by stating a few statistics. In South Africa, as many as 12% of university students experience anything from moderate to severe symptoms of depression. 15% report moderate to severe symptoms of anxiety. And one study has found that as many as 24% of a large sample of South African students reported some form of suicidal ideation in 2 weeks before they were in the 2 weeks that they were interviewed. The suicide rate among teens aged 10 to 14 has nearly doubled in the last 15 years. According to the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, South Africa's largest mental health initiative, 90% of adolescents who die by suicide have an underlying mental illness. The highest number of fatal suicides occur in the 15 to 19 age group. Stigma is definitely a problem. Many of us don't speak out or get help due to the stigma that is attached to mental illness. And I think we definitely need to inform and educate and support those that are suffering with mental illness. I also wanted to state that the high school dropout rates are, you know, incredibly high in South Africa, and that a lot of this can be attributed to a specific form of mental illness. And evidence suggests that only 1 in 6 students receive minimally adequate mental health treatment. Minimally adequate. So, yeah. You know, that one person might not even be getting much. So I first want, before we enter into the conversation, I just wanted to clarify a few, like, the terminology that surrounds mental health. So I think Zamo would be best to answer this. So I first wanted to ask you why you chose to study clinical psychology.
I mean, it's an FAQ, and I often struggle to give an answer to that. Very certainly, having studied it and having worked in predominantly the public healthcare sector, I'm glad I did make that decision, because there is a real need. I think there's a real need for healthcare practitioners who focus on mental health and mental illness in particular, and specialize in that area. I think that there's a very real need for black healthcare practitioners in particular,
yes.
Under the circumstances. And I think that when those two things kind of come together, it's probably a good recipe for having studied and practiced or trained and practiced as a therapist or a psychologist.
Okay, and how you found it navigating the health sector as a black professional?
Interesting, challenging at the best of times, though incredibly rewarding. I mean, I suppose it's a real privilege to be in a country and or on a continent where the majority of people are of your skin color or saturation and pigmentation. And so it's a real privilege to be able to help those of your own. I think it's also a real privilege, especially when it comes to linguistics, to also be able to take a training which is oftentimes seen as exclusive and elitist, and unfortunately up till recently been in the hands or the custodians have been not necessarily of the majority, to take that training and use, for example, your background, your race and your language capacities to help people. So mostly I found it a privilege. I found it really, really rewarding. Of course, there are challenges on both sides. I think there are challenges to break in and belong when majority of your colleagues or the training institutions are white. Fortunately, even there, there's an opportunity to transform it.
Yes.
And then there are also challenges when working with alike people. Questions such as, do black people really come to therapy? yeah. Or kind of helping people identify that this is a psychiatric or a severely psychological condition, and having some people say, no, not really, this is gibloy or misbehavior or something along those lines. So it's been many things. I think the aggregate of it, as I say, has been challenging and also incredibly rewarding.
Okay. Okay, well, that's positive to anyone listening who's studying clinical psychology. I just want to ask, in terms of terminology, what is anxiety, what is depression, and what is bipolar? So sure. Those three specifically.
How much time do we have? So, you know what I will do is I'll mostly give you a what we call kind of the clinical presentation, so what it looks like,
okay.
More than kind of an absolute definition, I think. Dr. Google will be good at that. So anxiety is something actually that we all in many different times have experienced, right? It's being anxious, it's being worried, and it has the physical symptoms, for example, of a knot in your stomach, dry mouth, finding it really difficult to think logically and straight, sweaty palms, sweating all over. Though anxiety disorder or the disorders under anxiety are experiencing that pervasively to the point that they can lead you to be dysfunctional or not be able to carry things, carry out duties that you need to.
Okay.
So in another way to access the conversation is anxiety can actually also really be helpful. So when you get anxious ahead of an exam, it's really helpful. It allows you to know that there's something really important coming up. And in fact, we also know from a neuro position, it can even help you focus. It can help you retain things. Anxiety disorders are the extreme of that, when it becomes actually unhelpful. So you're not remembering, you're not focusing. So I suppose the long and short of it is that anxiety is a long-standing, deep and intense set of symptoms, which include sweaty palms, a difficulty in breathing if you're having an anxiety attack, and they sustain themselves for a long time. So oftentimes we're anxious for a small period of time, but imagine having that feeling pervasively for weeks.
Wow.
Even struggling to go to sleep, struggling to eat, etc., etc. Imagine having the feeling of that you have before you're about to take your driver's license or write an exam, not just momentary, though for days, for months on end. It's exhausting. Depression is a low mood that is sustained for a long period of time and doesn't respond to things that would usually make you happy. In fact, it also takes happiness away. So again, Monday morning, we all get depressed. Soccer team loses, we all get a bit depressed. Arsenal fans know the most about anxiety and depression.
I've been there.
Because shout they out get to my dad.
Arsenal fans will tell you they get terribly anxious ahead of a game and incredibly depressed afterwards. as well. Though you can shake it off, right? You know, you feel bad or you feel low and you can shake it off. Depression, there are three markers. The first one is that you feel incredibly bad. You know, it's not that you feel a little bit bad, though you're able to focus on other things. And that's, I mean, we know that oftentimes you feel so bad that it is impossible to occupy your mind with anything else or yourself. You know, it's something that takes over your whole body. Yeah. And that's why sometimes a depression also leaves a person physically ill. So you feel intensely bad. Secondly, for a long period. So it's not just circumstantial that I'm going to feel bad for a couple of hours or a couple of days. You feel bad for weeks and sometimes months and sometimes even years. And there's no lift out of that feeling incredibly bad. And then the third point is that it doesn't respond to, for example, mates saying, let's go out for a drink or come have a coffee with me. Or watching something really funny on
television. Yeah, I think that's a
common
perception that sometimes, like, if you're trying to support your friend and you're thinking that just, like, you know, come on, let's go out, you know, let's, like, try pep each other up, that will solve it. But sometimes that's definitely not the solution.
In fact, we know that it can make it worse because oftentimes when people feel incredibly guilty for not wanting to do those things or even more confused, why am I not enjoying this? We know that when a person is depressed, for example, they do not enjoy the company of others or things that people find a lot of enjoyment in. They also become incredibly irritable. It's just one of the symptoms. So you find yourself going out and, you know, you're snapping and then you feel guilty and horrible. Those are some of the signs. Bipolar mood disorder is a kind of separate psychiatric disorder as well, where you get extreme lows of a depression. So you have depressions as well as extreme highs. So you get what we call mania. And in mania, some of the symptoms include not sleeping for weeks. And I know it sounds really ridiculous to people who have never experienced it. So for days or weeks, never running out of energy, though not being able to do productive things with that energy because your thoughts are racing, they're all over the place. You're finding it difficult to settle down. So bipolar disorder is kind of moving between those extreme lows and those extreme highs. And for a long period. And that's what I must clarify, is that it's not as if it's you know, in a day you kind of vacillate between those two. It's oftentimes a person may be manic or high for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and then incredibly depressed or low for a couple of days or a couple of weeks. And within that period, they are experiencing just the depression or just the mania. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Cool.
I just wanted to ask everyone in studio today why you think mental health among students is a conversation we need to be having, and why do you think it's an important topic, Zanele?
Okay, I think it's an important topic because it can impact you psychologically. It can impact your health, your academic life, your relationships, just your life. So it's something that has to be discussed, and a lot of people don't know what mental health is, which is a huge problem. So by us as students talking to each other, hopefully that can just, you know, help one student at least.
And I think even with you saying that a lot of people don't know what it is, I think a lot of our generation that are like being educated are actually educating our parents and our family members about what mental illness is, you know, what are we going through, and what they might also be struggling with but aren't aware of, you know, oh, it's depression, I'm not just, it's not just a phase, you know.
And with our parents also, because they probably went through depression themselves, right? So they're probably very dismissive of their own mental illnesses. So when they see their kids going through it, I know when I go through it, again, it's like, no, you'll be fine, or just like smile or whatever, because they said, well, I dealt with it, or I'm fine, which they aren't. We know they're not fine, but then they'll feel like, okay, well, you should be fine too. And it's not the case.
Yeah, it's definitely not the case. I was actually speaking, Zamo, when he came into studio, had asked me a question, and he said, Ruby, what sparked this conversation? You know, why do you want to speak about mental health among students? And I had said that, especially being at the University of Cape Town, we've received so many emails from our Vice Chancellor saying in the subject line, death of a student, you know, and within the email, the name and the age of the student is the only thing that's changed, you know. This year, I think we've received 12 maybe.
Quite a lot,
about
yeah.
12 emails from our university saying death of a student, and a lot of the deaths they don't want to specify as or categorize as suicide, but a lot of the times it definitely is suicide. But I think a lot of, I mean, it's not only UCT, but I can only speak from that perspective, you know, and not just statistics, something that these are emails that I'm receiving, that like tertiary institutions or educational institutions are kind of like turning a blind eye to the matter, or not really wanting to see like the extremity of what is happening. And then you also ask yourself as a black student, why are all these names in these emails of black people?
That's
you know,
very true.
Why am I not receiving emails about, you know, a fellow white peer who has passed on? And, you know, it's just questions that you ask yourself as, you know, why are black students struggling with mental health?
Also, it's very interesting that in UCT, the minority are black students.
Yeah,
so,
and we are the ones
and they're the only ones who are committing suicide.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
It's just a question you have to ask yourself. And I think the same things are happening at Wits, the same things are happening at Rhodes, UKZN, you know, it's just very worrying. And it's a conversation we need to have, and we have to find solutions.
That's very true.
We have to figure out who we need to, you know, talk to figure it out. In your experience, Zamo, what have you seen, like, specifically students struggling with in terms of mental illness?
I mean, it's... As you were speaking, I thought, wouldn't it be an apt title for a book or a talk, Death of a Student? Because for me, I think we need to speak about two different categories. The first one is mental illness that results in the death of a student.
Yes.
And there, the failure is adequate support. The failure is also a lack of access to the right services. So the second category, and perhaps for me the most important one, is death of a student by lack of mental wellness.
Yes.
So there are very many students who, in essence, could fit under the category of death of a student who do not commit suicide, though die very many other silent deaths.
I actually, on that point, I was asking a few of my friends, you know, this is the topic I'm talking about this week, you know, what has your experience been at university? And one of my friends said to me, she said, every morning when I've had to wake up for university, I have to choose, today am I choosing my academics or am I choosing my mental health? And that's, you know, exactly the point that you're saying. If you choose your academics and you know that you're suffering with something mentally or psychologically, then you're just a walking zombie, you know what I mean? You're handing in the assignments, you're going to lectures, but mentally you are not well.
Completely. And it starts all the way, I mean, to follow on what you're saying, you know, when I wake up in the morning, it starts all the way from home, and the pressures that a lot of people can face in the home environment. And I was saying that there's a real beauty and romanticism in the idea that it takes a village to raise a child, though it becomes a burden when that entire village's aspirations and ambitions are also kind of put on that child. And we see that in kind of our intergenerational shifts, is that for a lot of black South Africans, we're still having the first person going to university. And it's really beautiful and it's great at the same time, to the extent that we do not recognize how much of a burden it puts on the individual. It can actually be, unfortunately, lethal or fatal as well. Look, it starts at home, it goes all the way to the schooling environment, and how much pressure that environment has, especially if you're not used to it, how different and other you may feel, though also how incompetent. And there's no space for incompetence at university.
No, not at all.
At all, right? Especially if you've got into university, all smart people, you smart people here. it's not okay not to be okay at university.
That's
true. Which then means that you mask a lot of things, and they grow and they fester. And then beyond that, there are very limited services in the majority of our universities. So I suppose, you know, to speak quite broadly and vaguely, those are some of the experiences or the common experiences that that people face. This is not even touching on the idea that university going age in South Africa in many ways is a turbulent stage. I mean, many people are still just making sense of themselves in the world.
They haven't figured out what their identity is.
And then you're being asked to kind of have those two things sorted out. You must know who you are, and you must know what you're doing. And it's a big burden, and a lot of people kind of wear big suits and their parents' shoes in a false way, which is really terrible, and incredibly burdensome. So we could go on and on and on. I think perhaps it's important to say that one of the biggest challenges that is had at universities is a lack of support.
Yes, definitely.
The lack of insight, kind of conversation, access, making it okay to, you know.
Yeah, I think definitely what you're saying in terms of lack of support is very important, because a lot of universities might have, you know, student wellness centers or community clinics, but often they are very understaffed. So they aren't actually, you know, equipping students like they need to be equipped. I know a lot of people, you know, will go to like their student wellness and try to book an appointment, and there'll be a minimum of a 6-week wait.
Yeah.
But if a person, you know, is needing the help urgently right now, 6 weeks is, that's, you know, it's detrimental.
Yeah, I was at Monash University in 2016, and I was studying something I didn't want to study. I was basically making my parents feel happy that I'm going to school. And during the second semester exams, I really just didn't know how I was meant to study. I didn't even know how I was going to hand in my assignments. I just didn't know how I was going to function. And I went to the wellness center, and I wanted to book for, and this was like in maybe July, August. I wanted to book, and they said, no, our next available started like in October, you know, to November. And I was quite distraught that day. I was almost crying, and I was like, can I just see somebody? I just want to talk to somebody. And they couldn't see me because, you know, that's how full they are. So it was quite sad, you know, having to go through something like that.
Yeah. And it's so sad because you're not the only student that's gone through that. You know, there are thousands.
I feel like even now, like, remember Rez last year, people just be like, oh my God, guys, we have to pick between academics and our mental health. And then we'd just laugh. Like,
we just brush it off.
We're also embarrassed to say there's something wrong with me.
Yes.
And also, we're scared to actually admit that there's something wrong. Especially because universities, like their student wellness centers, aren't fully equipped. So we're scared to go there and be like, okay, then what's the point? Let's just laugh about it. Let's just carry on with our lives. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I just feel like we have a long way to go, but it's definitely important to have these conversations. But the question that it leads to is, who do we put the pressure on? Do we put the pressure on, you know, the Department of Health? Do we put the pressure on families and guardians? Do we put the pressure on educational institutions? Like, who can find the solution for us, or is it everyone working together?
In my uneducated opinion, because I'm not, like, you know, qualified or anything, I feel like it can't, by the time it gets to tertiary, it can't be parents anymore, because a lot of people are away from home.
Some people don't have parents.
Yeah, some people don't. People are away from, like, their... So my sister, she went to Stellenbosch, and she was away from all of her friends who stayed in Johannesburg. She didn't have the social, like, support or some sort of familial support, right? So at that point, even if at home we were supporting her and loving her and giving her what she needed, it was not enough because she's away. So I don't think putting it on families at that point is going to be helpful. Yeah.
So who do you think?
I think the institutions, and as well as Department of Health, especially if you're going to a public university like UCT or something, it's supposed to be hand in hand.
Mm.
Yeah.
And Zamo, in your opinion, who do you think the pressure should be on?
I mean, it's so. If I can say, I mean, you're the future leaders, right? You're the graduates sitting here. I'm curious to find out what you guys think. My sense is, I often think that we need to have a holistic approach to it all. So absolutely, when it comes to institutions such as UCT and other tertiary institutions, we need to help them as much as possible, because even they, at the best of times, would not know how to help, even though
that's
they want to help. So really kind of help them. And thank goodness, with in partnership with SEDIG, UCT has started a helpline. And it's not perfect. It's a really good start. And, you know, there's still a lot of work to do. So institutions, absolutely. I think the department is, I agree with you. I think that we do need to put a lot of pressure on the department to make mental health services accessible all over. The upsetting truth is that you know, we must balance out the resources so we can make UCT quite resourced in mental health care practitioners, and at the same time it's a fraction of the average black person who can goes to UCT.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So we're incredibly privileged even to be able to access the UCT and the services there. There are people, many more people, who are in the kind of informal sections of our country who absolutely not only need to access health mental health care services, though the knowledge that something is not okay in order to recognize it.
Isn't it so scary to think that, I definitely speak from a very privileged position, you know, going to University of Cape Town, that even I, in my privileged 1% position, I'm struggling to access the help that I need. What more, the majority of people who actually need more support than I may need. You know what I mean?
No.
It's just scary to think about.
So then the pressure, sorry to interrupt
don't worry.
is about a social pressure that we need to put pressure on ourselves all, really, to be speaking about mental health and mental illness, really, so that we can know about it, so we can prioritize it. You know, one of the only reasons that there's one psychologist to about 90,000 people on average it's about 100,000 actually in South Africa, is because we just don't, as a society, think of it as a priority.
Yes.
Yeah.
To a large extent. So that stat, just to put it into perspective, imagine Soccer City full to capacity and one psychologist servicing all of those people.
And that psychologist needs a psychologist
exactly.
to deal with.
Yeah. So he has to go to the next F&B stadium filled with people in order to access it. So what I'm trying to get at is that we just don't prioritize it enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't speak about it enough. We don't speak accurately about it. And there is a lot of shame and stigma. Yeah. And there's a lot of kind of censorship, even generationally, that happens as well.
That's very true.
Okay. That's a good point. On that note, I think we're going to have a music break and then we'll get back to the topic.
This is CliffCentral.com. And if you think that I'm still holding on to something, you should go and love yourself. Cause if you like the way you look that much, oh baby, you should go and love yourself. And if you think that I'm still holding on to something, you should.
Okay, well, as the song said, love yourself. So before the break, we were speaking about, you know, who do we need to put pressure on? Is it educational institutions? Is it the health department? Or is it, you know, families and support structures? And in our break, we were discussing, you know, is it our responsibility as students, you know, who have just graduated or who are in university, who have the privilege of, you know, having access to this type of information and these type of facilities, you know, to learn about mental illness and to be more aware, is it our responsibility to raise awareness and to help our fellow peers who do not have the same access that we do? What do you think, Zani?
Personally, this is such a tough question. As I was saying during the break, it is our responsibility as a student body to maybe like start small organizations and have relationships with students that are, example, in Khayelitsha or Guguletu, and then maybe just like visit them once a month. But also, as a student, you're going through a lot yourself. You may be going through depression and you do not know, but you're helping someone else. So I guess we just have to find the balance. But I do think some of it has to come from the students, because we've already seen now institutions don't know what to do. We're the ones that are pushing student wellness centers to actually do their job. We're the ones that are actually pushing government. So, but the thing is, it can't only come from the students. The government, institutions, and yes, our parents don't know what mental health is. We have to educate them, but they have to be willing to learn. Many black parents are not willing to learn.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So how do we get our black parents willing to learn?
How do we get our black parents willing to learn? I don't know how to answer that. By force,
guys. Sometimes you just gotta have to just, like...
Thing is, you can say by fire, by force, but sometimes black parents only learn when something bad happens to their child.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because you can continuously speak about like, oh, mom, no, I'm struggling at school, I'm struggling at school. And they'll be like, no, but it's easy. And then once they maybe see you fail, they'll just be like, oh. Or some parents are just like, no, you were butting, that's why you failed, when you were actually not butting. So it's like, with parents, it's a tough one. I cannot answer that question.
Yeah, I think that's a whole nother topic alone. Yeah. How do we get black parents to be more open-minded to, you know, learn that the struggles that we are going through as students, as youth, are a completely different world to what they experienced. But yeah, I think that's another topic for another day.
I want to interject just because, you know, I think it's important. I mean, I think when we were speaking yesterday, you gave me carte blanche to have a conversation just about being a young person in the world, so to speak, and not just. And my contribution at the moment is a little bit challenging of what you're saying, because I think that it can be easiest to expect our parents or the parent to see your struggle, and then get frustrated when it's not possible. Though perhaps we really need to think about why it's impossible for them to do that. Firstly, what makes it difficult, and the what and why, and to throw maybe the cat amongst the pigeons, I wonder if you're expecting a lot from parents who have had in many ways to deny their own strife and struggle.
Yeah.
They've had to, right, in order to keep going. I wonder if it's a lot to expect them to then turn around and see yours when they've had to turn a blind eye to their own and kind of numb themselves for themselves and for you to psychic and psychological pain, to then imagine that they would even know how to see it for you.
Yeah, that's true. That's why when I said by vibe, by force, I just feel like it's a matter of you just put yourself, like, regardless of if they see it or not, you see it. And you kind of just have to, you put it out there, always put it out there and always put yourself first, right? And whether they see it or not, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but you always just kind of have to make sure you prioritize yourself and not prioritize them seeing it.
Yes.
Because they'll see it or they won't, but as long as you put in yourself there, by fire or by force, at least you're taking care of yourself, you know what I mean? But like, they will see, you know, and even if they see it and they can't help you, they've seen it. You know, that's, I think that's what's important. So, yeah.
I think also it's definitely a learning process. Yeah. I don't think, you know, it's going to be one child going to their family one day and saying, you know what, actually, when you say this to me, it really triggers something mentally for me. You know what I mean? And then the family all of a sudden gets into gear and understands and changes the way they do things. I think it's a learning process. I think with what you were saying, is it too much to expect? Yes, it's a lot to expect, but transformation is not easy.
Yeah. Definitely.
And we do have to change our culture.
We need to start challenging our culture in order for transformation to happen.
But as long as you're doing the work, if they come around, they come around. If they don't, they don't. I think, you know, I mean, not that they are lost cause or anything, but you just have to, you have to say, put it out there for them to see. And if they don't see it, you just have to move forward for you. And you are the transformation then, you know? So that's my point. Yeah.
I think also at the same time with the initial question that we had asked of, you know, who is responsible, because obviously something is very wrong in terms of mental illness among students. I think definitely a lot of it can stem with the Department of Health, because if the culture changes as a society that we actually recognize mental illness, we actually are more aware of mental health. If in every school there are talks regularly in whichever language it is, consistently from grade one, you know, there is such thing as anxiety. Before exams, these are the things I can do to calm myself down. Exactly.
They take tests in grade one still.
You know what I mean? It's like all of a sudden, you know, you don't talk about this for 18 years of your life, and then you get into the real world, or you get into university or a tertiary institution or a technicon, and then boom, depression. Oh, there's such a thing. You know, I think the conversation needs to be had from much early on, and the only people that can implement it specifically into life orientation, you know, so that it's not a free period, which it was what it is, but it specifically needs to, like, a lot of our curriculum needs to change. I think, in my opinion, life orientation is that subject, because that it can actually that should be helping us, that should be equipping us with the skills of, if it is manageable, how do we manage it, and if we need to seek help, how do we seek help. I think that's the only way it's going to start, because it's very difficult to change people's perceptions after the age of 18. It mm-hmm. becomes very difficult. But if it's something you've been speaking about your whole life, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's a lot easier to understand. If whoever you like, you know, your guardians are, mm-hmm. you come back from home and you're doing, you know, you're telling your parent that you've had a talk about depression or about whatever, and you're 7 years old, and then you're 15 years old, and then you're 16 years old, and then you're 18. I think eventually families will start to definitely understand, yes. Oh, okay, this is a serious thing. Mm-hmm. It's being put into the curriculum. It's being prioritized by society. Mm-hmm. So let's shift it into gear. And if that happens from a lower level, I think educational institutions at a tertiary level will also shape up.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think it starts with us of putting pressure onto our departments and definitely. Saying, listen, we're struggling. We're struggling.
It's also sad because we're going through a lot ourselves. So it cannot only be us.
But it has to start with us.
Yeah, but it has to start with us, definitely.
Because, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, you know, maybe they'll realize, oh, you know, why aren't they doing their jobs? Mm. Oh, don't they see that these are the statistics? Don't they see they're sending out 12 emails to me, death of a student? Don't they see something is wrong?
Yeah.
You know? But it has to start with us. We have to put the pressure on. So, you know, hopefully that will be our task.
Yeah.
I have a few personal experiences from different students who will be represented as anonymous of what their experience with mental illness has been during their time as a student. So the first one is, the first time I realized I was depressed was in my second year of university. It felt that different parts of my life were falling apart. School, fees must fall had started. I was battling with my identity and friendships were falling apart. The best way to describe depression for me is that everything is an uphill battle. Even the smallest tasks are extremely difficult to do. I found it hard to get out of bed. I was constantly tired. I went through a stage of denial. Happy moments felt like a distant memory. I realized that everything felt so sad and dark for a very long time. It was tough because mental illness is not discussed in African families. The advice my mother gave me was to pray about it. And although I believe in prayer, this felt dismissive to me. Depression does not always present itself as a person who looks sad, and I feel my university does not prioritize my mental health. Okay, the second excerpt I have is, since 2011, I felt that the feelings I was experiencing emotionally were not normal. I thought it was just a sad phase that would be easy to overcome. Fast forward to 2017, as a university student, these very same emotions began to cripple me physically. I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep. I was worried because my daily living was so badly affected that I couldn't reach my full potential. Things like my hygiene and relationships were negatively affected. I kept thinking, but I'm strong. There's no way I'm depressed. I took an online mental health assessment that diagnosed me with severe depression, but I ignored it because I thought, what does it know? After battling with suicidal thoughts, I contacted a psychiatrist who diagnosed me with severe depression. Hearing this made me realize that everything I was feeling was not just a phase, but rather a severe mental illness. Okay, and then the last experience I have to share is, suffering with depression was something I never understood or could explain because of the stigma behind it in the Black community and in my family. I always thought I was just being silly and that I was not normal, which was something I carried with me throughout high school and university. I ended up having to leave university for a while because it was something I never dealt with, as well as the pressure of my surroundings just made it worse. Although I'm in a better place now, I am still fighting. Yeah, I think that's definitely very deep, but that's what students are struggling with, you know, and that's just a very small percentage, you know, those are three stories. That definitely doesn't represent, you know, the entire student body in South Africa. But I think, you know, sometimes hearing someone's personal story or how they would explain their experience kind of puts it into perspective to say, you know, if someone's saying that, I'm struggling with my hygiene. I'm struggling to bath 2 times a day because mentally this is crippling me. Mm-hmm. You know, what more carrying on with the, you know, your average day-to-day tasks or going to lectures or submitting your assignments on time? You know, how do you cope? Yeah, I think it's just very difficult. I think it also makes you very sad because we need the support. I mean, these are just like cries for help. And I think this is definitely a start, you know, using whichever platforms you have to have these conversations. But this is only the start. It's only a stepping stone.
Definitely.
I suppose the one thing that I do want to point out in all three, firstly, I think that it's you know, they really do represent the majority of people. More people, particularly at a tertiary institution, struggle or suffer with psychological distress than ever admit, know, or disclose. It's the statistics you were reading out earlier are incredibly conservative. It's probably around 75% of people at some point. And it's a pity that, you know, as I said, admit, acknowledge, or disclose. Though in all three of those, there was a deep sense of aloneness. And I think one of the elements that drives that aloneness is that people do not really ask or care to listen anymore.
Yes.
And in that regard, no matter how many therapists you have or psychiatrists or whatever the case is, it's going to be no good unless we really ask and we really care to listen. So the WHO's theme for 2017 in mental health was dare to ask. Really dare to ask, for example, how a person's doing, or what's wrong, or how are you coping, or what are you struggling with. One of the most asked questions in the world, next to what's your Wi-Fi password, is how are you? Though it's the least listened to in terms of answer. And it's also the least engaged with from a position of honesty as well. And that is a responsibility that we need to take.
But, like, what happens? Because I know, like, in varsity, especially this year and last year, like, you'd be asking your friend, hey, how are you? And you're actually really listening. Mm. But they continuously keep on lying to you. And then I know everyone says, check on your friends. But what if you check on your friends, but they continuously lie to you? What do you do next? I know you can always be there for them, but what if you want to do more? What steps can you take as the friend to try help your friend to open up or at least recognize that there is something wrong?
And that's a really good question. So how do you help, I suppose, is the question that you're asking. Especially because oftentimes a person who's struggling, particularly with the depression, is feeling so helpless that there's no motivation to do anything. It's no good to say to a friend, look, you need help, and then to leave the room. You need to help them get the help. So to the extent that the two of you need to make the appointment to go see the counselor or or a psychologist or psychiatrist together. And I think we're really good at drinks dates. We show up and we do it, though not so much at helping dates. That we actually have a date and I'll come with you.
Yes.
And I'll make it okay and I'll be supportive. And I'm not necessarily going to make jokes so that it's easy.
The only time like students actually really open up is Friday night when they drunk. That's when you find out that something's wrong. Yeah.
And then make an appointment for Monday coffee and say, listen, I'm aware that this happened and you said this and it may be embarrassing or difficult to talk about, but I cannot ignore it.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you help friends that can't have access to certain things?
Such as, like...
Like, for example, let's say the university is booked until next year, February. And you don't have medical aid and you don't have you don't have easy access to the psychologist around you or someone around you
or your family isn't supportive
and your family isn't supportive, so that you can tell that friend's family is already dismissive, you know. How do you help that person if they don't even have the tools and you don't have the tools? What do you do then?
And I think where you end off is important, is that at the best of times you can find yourself in deep waters because you do not have the tools, and then there are two helpless people drowning together, and that's when you need to recruit the professional or some sort of professional help. And you're asking, how do you do that when they're limited? On the one hand, that's where we come in, as for example the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, and offer free telephonic counseling. to the extent that we could even call you back, actually,
mm-hmm.
And help you over the phone. Or you could send us a message and we could call you, though, you know. We can also refer you to resources around you which do not need a lot of financial muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's your local clinic, and this is where government, for example, has done some good work, absolutely not enough, where we do have social workers and psychologists and psychiatrists, and you do not need money to access them. Or the support groups. I think we have about 200 support groups around the country that one can access as well. That's where you might be able to get the help, which is not so financially strenuous.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think those are definitely good options. Mm. I think we also have to expand our minds to think, you know, I only knew about the South African Anxiety and Depression Group because I Googled it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I Googled, you know, what is the support for mental health in South Africa? But if someone doesn't have access to that facility to even know that there
exists.
Exists, or that there is a support group, or that there is someone that can aid me without, you know, me having to fork out a lot of money.
Or that UCT now has a helpline.
Exactly.
Which is toll free, 0800 24 25 26, if I remember correctly.
Yes. But I'm just saying, you know, we have to really start thinking about how do I, as an individual, increase awareness surrounding, you know, mental illness around the youth and among students.
So here's another challenge. So I'm not certain how many tweets I'm not au fait with Twitter, though. How many times you've tweeted today? What are the chances that you've tweeted about SADEG or about toll free lines or about you know, there's a growing trend that say that we tag a friend and remind them to drink water. Though wouldn't it be great if it was tag a friend and find out how they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No,
that's, I think, yeah, after this conversation and, you know, thinking about it a lot more, there are a lot of things we need to do to challenge ourselves, because something has to change.
Can I bring up a quick question?
Yes.
One more. Okay, so what happens if there's an acquaintance or a stranger you can definitely tell is going through the most, and you know they're not about to tell you how they're doing, or even offer, accept help from you? What do you do? How do you handle those situations that you can see someone's going through it, they're going through the most, but you don't know how to penetrate their safe space?
So there are a couple of ways to think about it. I'll give you a bit more of a, hopefully it won't be too abstract. There's a great book that says, Leave Me Alone, I Need Your Help.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks about the frustration of going through the most, apparently is the term. and one of the conversations that's had in that book is that I need you to be there. I do not want you to be intrusive, and mm-hmm. at the same time, I do not want you to go away until I can know for myself that it's safe enough for me to reach out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
to some extent. And we all know that experience, because we've all been teenagers. And our parents are either incredibly intrusive and they want to know what happened at school.
Mm-hmm.
And that does not foster a conversation. Though as soon as they leave the room, there's also a big problem, because you accuse them of not being involved.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps instead of them that says, I'm going to sit here and read until you're ready to talk. Not just in the moment, though in the forever of it. Mm-hmm. I'm here.
Okay. So I guess what we can do is be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all we can do. Not that we can solve the problem, but as long as you're available and you're willing to care and listen.
Available and accessible.
Available and accessible. I just wanted to ask Zamo, you know, just to finish this off, what would your message be to students or to youth that are listening and that are struggling with mental health at the moment? You know, what would your, maybe a few self-care tips, what would they be?
I think the first one is, you're really not alone. What is a big pity is how many people struggle and struggle in silence, not knowing that the person to the left and right of their sitting with them in a lecture hall is also struggling. So you're not alone. Really, you're not alone. You're amongst many people who are struggling. I think the second one I often say is, and there's also help. There's a great deal of help that you can get. in the courage to say, I'm not okay. It's an incredibly brave thing to say, I'm not okay. Though that is okay, yeah, actually.
It's okay to not be okay.
It's incredibly brave and courageous to say that. I think on a practical level, there are also really important tips, such as self-care is important. Self-care is about going out and having a good time as much as it is, at the best of times, about staying in and quietening your mind.
Mm.
I think it's important to try as hard as possible to be as honest and open with the people around you, find a good support system, support structures, and keep it and work at it to a large extent, and never be afraid to go to the professional. People will go to the GP when they're not feeling well, though it's hard to go to the therapist when go and find yourself some professional help.
Okay. Okay, well, to end this off, I'd just like to give a few numbers. The suicide crisis line is 0800-567-567. The SADAG mental health line is 011-234-4837. And the ADCOC Ingram Depression and Anxiety Helpline is 0800-70-80-90. I would like to thank Zamo, Chioma and Zanele for joining me in studio
today. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I think the biggest takeaway from today is be available and be accessible. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.